Welcome to the Rare Earth Elements podcast. I'm your host, Bridget Scanlon, from the Bureau of Economic Geology at the Jackson School of Geosciences at the University of Texas at Austin. In this podcast, we discuss rare earth element feedstocks with experts from academia, industry, and government. The discussions include a variety of potential feedstocks, particularly waste materials, and innovations in processing technologies to improve rare earth element supply chains in the U.S. I would like to welcome Chris Young to the podcast. Chris is the Chief Strategy Officer at Element USA, and today we're going to talk about processing critical minerals and rare earth elements from a variety of feedstocks, but mostly red mud or bauxite residue. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining me.
You're welcome, Bridget, and thanks for having me.
So, Chris, we've been chatting back and forth for maybe a year and a half now through the Department of Energy CoreCM project, looking at feedstocks for rare earth elements. And I really appreciate you reaching out and connecting with us. And so your company, Element USA, is looking at using various feedstocks and trying to extract rare earths and critical minerals. Maybe you can give us a bit of background about Element USA.
Certainly, Bridget. Thanks. We started the company really focused on red mud or bauxite residue, which are the tailings in the aluminum supply chain. Wherever there's an alumina refinery around the world, for roughly for every ton of alumina that's produced, a ton to a ton and a half of byproduct or red mud or bauxite residue is produced. And Element USA started in 2020, 2021, focused on the red mud that exists in Louisiana. The larger resource is the one at Gramercy, Louisiana, where there's 30 million tons and growing a million tons a year because it's the last operating refiner in the U.S., but also have been working on the Burnside red mud. And the Gramercy red mud is a very valuable red mud because it's sourced bauxite as a karst bauxite out of Jamaica, which has much higher rare earth content. So you obviously have the iron, hence the red color, and other valuable minerals like alumina, titanium, but you've got rare earth content in the 3,000 to 4,000 ppm in the bauxite residue. So it's a great resource. Not only is it a great resource from an element standpoint, but it's a great resource to be sitting in Louisiana on the Mississippi River, where you've got great access to logistics and you've got good costs from a power, gas, and reagent perspective.
Right. And then the coastal location then, I guess, will allow you to possibly access other feedstocks that you might import also.
Exactly.
And I guess Gramercy is located there because they were importing the bauxite from Jamaica.
Exactly. Yeah, Bridget, the Kaiser Aluminum built both the bauxite export operation in Jamaica concurrent and for the purpose of supplying bauxite into the Gramercy, Louisiana refinery back in the early 1960s. So they've been a supplier-customer relationship for over 60 years.
Right. And so during that time, then it's nice that you mentioned for each ton of alumina they generate a ton to a ton and a half of red mud. And this red mud then has concentrated metals and a lot of rare earths. So maybe describe the Gramercy site a little bit. You've got these ponds with the red mud and one dry stacked site.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, sure. The Gramercy site is about halfway between New Orleans and Baton Rouge on what's considered the east side of the Mississippi River. It's a little bit more on the north side where the Mississippi's flowing at that point. There are four mud lakes where it's, call it, the mud's coming right out of the operation. Impoundment areas number one through four. But the site now is dry stacking or filter pressing about half of their production, and that goes into mud lake impoundment number six. So these mud lakes have levees built around them. So they're basically large ponds to control the storage of these materials. The filter pressing squeezes most of the liquid out. So it actually flips the ratio of liquid and solid. And so now you can store that into mounds. You can therefore extend the life of these impoundment areas. Obviously, that's not the greatest value. The greatest value is figuring out how to separate that red mud into its component elements and put it into the marketplace. So these impoundments are as deep as 40 feet deep and have been there for several decades. And that's true everywhere in the world. Wherever there's an alumina refinery, there are impoundment areas where the red mud is stored. Over the last, between 2 and 3 decades ago, the industry has moved towards storing that red mud. And it's a cost. So there's both a cost to managing these impoundments from a capital expense, from an operating expense. And then the flip side of that is there's a great opportunity for the industry in general. It's not easy to separate it or it'd be done already. So that's the situation as it is. And we're excited to be sitting kind of on the precipice of developing a solution for extracting value out of the red mud in Louisiana.
Right, right. And maybe also we have a couple of sites in Texas that Alcoa has where we've got red mud and quite a lot of it at the Copano site, maybe 100 million tons or so. So that's also another potential site.
It is. Yeah, both of them are of value. The Copano site that's near Corpus actually used about 2/3 Jamaican bauxite. I was involved with shipping that material from Jamaica when I was actually working for the Gramercy business at that time. So it's nearly as valuable as the Gramercy mud, but a great source as well. And then Point Comfort, Texas has a couple hundred million tons plus. Not quite as rich in rare earths, but still there's a lot of value in it. And obviously the iron itself can be used in the steel industry. And the United States imports roughly 5 million tons a year of pig iron to serve the electric arc furnace steel market. So any red mud around the world becomes a potential source for metallic iron to go into the steel industry. Something as basic as that, but it's still sitting in a waste pile.
Right, right.
Figure that out.
Well, I mean, the USGS has this mantra, or waste to resources or trash to treasure. So I think now there's a lot of emphasis in trying to extract critical materials from these waste and recovering from those. So to produce the alumina from the bauxite, then it's the bare process. So sodium hydroxide. And so the material then has a pretty high pH. The red mud has a fairly high pH, maybe 11 or 12 pH when you're done with that process.
Correct.
And the Gramercy site then you mentioned has about 30 million tons of red mud or more. And so what is the projected lifespan that you think if you created a plant then to extract various materials from that? How long do you think if Gramercy stopped operating now? And you said it produces about a ton a year. So
A million tons,
30 million tons.
Bridget, in our modeling for the flow sheet, the base flow sheet we've developed, we used 1 million ton a year for the size of the plant. So obviously, if the plant continues to operate, we'd really need to double the size of the red mud separation plant in order to draw it down to zero. So, but in a hypothetical, if there was a cessation of operations, you're looking at a 30-year operation at 1 million tons a year. I know that certainly in our discussions with the local officials, there's certainly a desire to repurpose that material. And I know that one of the first times we had a kind of a collective meeting with some of the state officials said, oh, how quickly can you draw down that red mud? And I said, well, it's been put there for 30 years. It's going to take a little while to draw it down. Understand the desire, but it's going to take a little while.
Right, right. And so you mentioned then that the red mud, about half of it is iron and that the U.S. imports a lot of iron. So then you have a special process, and I can't recall the name that I saw for the material that you're going to produce.
Yeah, we called it eco iron just because it's coming out of a waste stream. So in our base flow sheet, we're using carbothermal reduction to convert the iron oxide that's sitting in the red mud into a metallic iron. And it's of a spec that can go into the steel industry, among other industries. But obviously, the large consumer of iron in the United States is the steel industry.
Right. And then not all the aluminum has been extracted. And so there's some aluminum, but the rare earth elements, I mean, the numbers just blow me away, the concentrations of the rare earths. I mean, we have limited data from the Gramercy site, and you mentioned 4,000 parts per million. That's about 20 times or more the average concentration in the continental crust. So maybe some people are confused, rare earth elements are rare, but really they're not rare, but you don't ever get them concentrated as ores. But this type of concentration, where it's 20 times the continental crust, that's just amazing. And fairly uniformly across all of the elements, they're all concentrated. And so the permanent magnets like praseodymium, neodymium, terbium, dysprosium, they're all 20 times at the Gramercy site. And then, of course, scandium. I mean, scandium is the highest value rare earth. I was just looking it up, maybe $3,000 a kilogram.
It can be, it has been as high as 3,000 a kilogram. And as you and I have talked about, the scandium, as in a scandium aluminum alloy, can really significantly reduce the weight of aerospace applications. I think a figure that sometimes is used, it could be as much as $9 million savings in fuel per year by using the scandium aluminum alloy. So, yeah, the scandium's an intriguing one because the global market technically understands the value of scandium, but users, potential users of scandium aluminum alloys, are reluctant to adopt that alloy as their material for fear that the supply chain gets interrupted and they've gone through a significant process of recapitalizing their operations to use the alloy and then run the risk of the scandium supply being cut off, because today most of the scandium is coming out of China and Russia, which puts you at risk. As we know, that China's a couple, certainly 15 years ago, cut off supply of rare earths. So if you're the C-suite of a major company that's deploying alloys for making the skin, for instance, of aerospace companies and operations, that's a risk that's too big. But I think the cool thing is that we're starting to see some other scandium suppliers, namely Rio Tinto is now making scandium aluminum alloys. They're extracting the scandium out of the wastes from their iron operations up in Quebec. So I think over the next 5 to 10 years, I think we're going to see significant growth in scandium. Back to your earlier comment, Bridget, I always find it interesting. Yeah, the rare earths are everywhere, but just in such a low concentration. And we get excited about 3,000 to 4,000 ppm. I always give the story that if someone who's kind of an old salt and been around rare earths a long time, like the alumni of MP Materials or the old Molycorp, and their technology is solvent extraction, they may be a little bit long in the face when they hear those ppms. But if you're doing work on other alternative sources, people usually lean in with a big smile and say, that's a high concentration of rare earth. So we'll get there. We'll figure out how to get that out.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when you mentioned Mountain Pass, MP Materials, I mean, you look at their concentrations, it's mostly light rare earths, the lanthanum, cerium, and just the very light ones are the highest concentrations from that igneous source, carbonatite. So that's not that great, really, these days when we are interested in a lot of the heavies. On your website, you mentioned a Boeing 747 would be 15% weight reduction with a scandium aluminum alloy, and that's your $9 million fuel savings a year.
Yeah, it's real. It's real. I think the scandium opportunity is huge for industry as we reshore some of these industries.
And I think the aerospace industry is very interested in scandium because of this. So we have the Bureau, Brent Elliott and Rich Kyle and I have been working on the Red Muds in the Copano site. You mentioned that maybe there's mostly Jamaican, but also Brazil bauxite in there. And so concentration's about half of what you see at the Gramercy site, but still, I mean, 10 times the continental crust and fairly uniform across all of the elements. So we were estimating if we had 120 million tons of rare earths at that site, and we were looking at rare earths plus yttrium and scandium, it would be about, and we assume 50% extractability, we would get about $12 billion worth from the rare earths and the scandium. And then the permanent magnets would be about $3.5 million. But I mean, they're just real back of the envelope doodling.
Hey, it's worthy of raising the eyebrow. Those are big numbers.
Yes, and the fact that all of the permanent magnet rare earths are also 10 times, and the scandium is 10 times. These are all good. And then at the Gramercy, then it's more like 20 times at least. And yttrium is also very high at these sites. That's more than 20 times continental crust. So I don't know if you are down the road enough. One thing is the high concentrations, and the other thing then is the extractability and the chemical cost to do this. I've been reading some papers, and I saw some papers where they said scandium 80% extractability with some acids and stuff. Do you have any ideas yet on what your extractability will be?
We're modeling 50% extractability for the rarest other than scandium. On the scandium material, there are proven technologies using carbonization to get about 30% of the scandium. But we're working with a number of different partners. And this is a little bit of the story about what we're doing at the Critical Resource Accelerator is we're developing flow sheets for extracting value out of alternative sources, out of wastes and tailings like the red mud. And the way we're developing those flow sheets is we'll do a lot of the heavy lifting on the separation, particularly on the front side, but then partner with very specific technology owners at extracting specific elements and to improve the extractability, the extraction of those elements. And I always describe this as we're bringing together different Lego parts, and there are some really great technologies that are coming forth around using catalysts, around using electrowinning, that are much better at identifying one or a small number of elements and extracting it from a larger combination of materials. Another way of thinking about it is, hey, we're the prime, but we're actually working in the defense industry of primes and subs. So we're the prime, and then we're kind of knocking on the door of subs saying, hey, we'd like to deploy your technology to extract yttrium or to get a higher concentration of the scandium out of that in particular industrial waste stream that we're working with. So I think the opportunity is there in front of us. We've got a lot more work to do on the red mud, but I think it's going to accelerate quickly here in the next 6 months.
Right. And you mentioned the accelerator, and maybe you can describe to the listeners, this is the accelerator in Round Rock, just north of us.
Yes. It's in Cedar Park, and we've got 30,000 square feet of space. It's a research operation where we've got an analytical lab where we can do mineral characterization, defining what elements and what is the mineralogy in a particular waste. And then we can conduct the laboratory experiments, the bench scale experiments, and the pilot for developing flow sheets for extracting value out of different wastes. And the world we're focused on is inorganic industrial waste. So this would be from the aluminum industry, from the steel industry, from carbon, coal, the coal industry, copper tailings, phos gypsum. And so what we do from a process standpoint is go through that characterization and then determine pathways to liberate and then separate and then commercialize the value that sits in a waste stream, like in the red mud. While we started on red mud and we're continuing to work on the red mud, we were coming across other opportunities that we saw this type of model being very apropos and strategic. In addition to that, we were getting phone calls from people saying, hey, can you take a look at our waste stream to see what you might do with it? So we're bringing together research experts in the world of extractive metallurgy, hydrometallurgy, mineral processing, which gets into physical separation, grinding, separating using density and surface area, and bringing those different disciplines to bear to extract the value out of different wastes and incubating new businesses that would be specific to a waste stream, and even in some cases, a particular waste location. Given the waste that we're talking about, usually you're sitting in, not unlike red mud, where you've got 30 million tons in Gramercy, typically your fly ash is sitting in a large volume of 10 to 20 million tons, just like the power plant we're talking to that you and Brent have introduced us to. So we're bringing to bear the disciplines, a multidisciplinary approach from a scientific standpoint, but with an eye absolutely towards commercializing economically businesses for extracting value. The team has operating experience in mineral processing, in the aluminum industry, in the steel industry. So we really bring an operational view towards applying science to extract these values.
Right. That's amazing. And visited your accelerator recently, and it's very impressive. See students and employees and all sorts of new equipment and everything. So I'm very impressed with how rapidly you're ramping up that accelerator. And you'll
Bridget, I appreciate you coming up to see it. And we value, part of the reason we ended up in Texas, Bridget, is certainly the University of Texas at Austin is a powerhouse university, and you and the university have put a stake in the ground to say to increase the impact that the University of Texas Austin has in mineral characterization and critical mineral exploration. So that's certainly part of the reason why we ended up in the Austin area.
Right, right. And so one of the things that impressed me about the description of Gramercy and what you were planning on doing with it is that you mentioned zero waste discharge. So you're going to use all of the material. And so maybe describe that for me a little bit. I mean, so if you've got the wet pits, that's 50% water, 50% mud, and then you've got 50% of the mud is iron and on and on.
One of our guiding principles is that we have zero solid waste after processing a waste. So specific to the red mud, we anticipate that on a dry basis, 20 to 25% of the volume of the weight after separation of iron, alumina, rare earths will be still sitting in a residual, right? The residual after processing this waste residue. And so we're doing a lot of work in the cement and construction markets, work in the form of testing to deploy that material. So in the case of red mud, and this is true in a lot of industrial waste, you'll have a residual that's going to have some combination of silica, alumina, some residual iron, those being the largest three components, some residual calcium, some residual titanium. So it becomes a very suitable material to feed into the cement and concrete markets. And at least in the United States alone, the cement market's about 100 million tons. The concrete market is about 400 million tons. So it becomes a good candidate for putting materials into those industries. Additionally, we've been doing testing with a couple partners for putting it right into road base. And depending on the market, like the state of Louisiana, where there really is no aggregate in the Louisiana market, the aggregate that serves the construction market in Louisiana typically is being barged downriver, down the Mississippi River, or imported from the Yucatan Peninsula. So those will be the primary locations where the residual then be repurposed as a feedstock into the cement slash concrete market or the road construction market, so we can achieve that zero solid waste goal for each waste.
Right. And so the goal then for Gramercy, I mean, if you process all of this waste and then you would just fill back up the pits and remediate the site, is that the long-term idea?
That would be a great day when we're having a discussion about what are we going to do with these couple hundred acres that used to be filled with red mud?
Yeah.
The short answer is yes to that discussion.
And so whatever they would make from the rare earths and the other materials, then that could help offset the remediation costs.
Yes. Yeah. And I think most mine operations have to set aside some capital for remediation. But the purpose of that set aside capital typically is that you're having to cover over with dirt or some other remediation. It'll be a different day and a different discussion when the remediation is, all right, now we've actually emptied the impoundment areas of all the red mud. And that now becomes a development opportunity to put other industries there. So I say that with a slight smile on my face. It'll take a little while to get there, but I think that would be the goal. And so actually the remediation capital that's set aside could be civil work to go put in a new type of industrial operation or perhaps some other commercial development. That'd be a great day. That will be a great day.
Right. And I mean, the Kopono site and Gramercy, I mean, these are close to sea level. And so removing these very high pH material would be very important for the environment.
It would. I think these materials, the red mud in particular, it is a high pH material. It's not, people always ask me, is it toxic? And I go, you can go pick it up and put it in your hand. You need to wash your hand off after you put it back down in the impoundment area. Around the world, there's a lot of different efforts being tested for repurposing the red mud. And one of those is neutralizing the pH in order to make that land, if you will. And these are in other climates that are drier climates. So you can make that land repurposable, if you will. But yeah, ideally we go use that red mud up, and then there can be a different discussion for whoever owns that land.
Right. And so when you describe what Element USA would do, will you not do the processing much yourself, or would you look to other companies then to do the processing?
Each waste will be a separate business discussion, Bridget. We anticipate that we will be running the business for separating the red mud, partly because of the contractual relationship we've already got set up for the red mud that's in Louisiana. For other red muds, that would be a discussion with the waste owner. What role do they want to play? What active do they want to play in that incubating that new business? And if that's true for each waste is, hey, some waste owners may say, hey, you're really outside of the bailiwick strategically that we're involved with. Hey, we'd like a licensing fee for the value of the waste that's being used. Other companies may say, you know what? We like what you guys are doing. We'd like to come alongside you and partner with you. So that model is dependent really on the waste owner's strategy and their deployment-ish desires.
Right, right. But at least you'll be doing the Gramercy work anyway. And so you will create a rare earth oxide then, and then you will market that.
Yes. For each material, Bridget, there's a discussion, how far do we go in the supply chain? I always say that we can't boil an ocean. If we're making iron, alumina, scandium, neodymium, and praseodymium, a residual, and there are other materials in there, like you said, yttrium, vanadium, chromium. Each one of those supply chains, just from an operational standpoint, requires its own set of expertise in processing. So for each material, there's a question, how far down the supply chain do we go? And then where do we do that handoff with the next step in the process? So it could be for rare earth elements, we make a mixed rare earth concentrate of 20 or 40%, and we hand that off to someone else who's in the business of taking a concentrate like that and taking it to a 4N oxide. So each material becomes a strategic discussion of, hey, what's the complexity? Who's out there in the marketplace that we can partner with? And what's our ability to identify the proper place to hand it off?
Right, right. And so, so that's really interesting. And of course, the prices of rare earths are kind of volatile.
Yeah.
But with all of the other materials that you're creating, that will stabilize your market, I would assume. The other products, briquettes, pellets, this, of iron, and all of these other materials. So that would help to stabilize your market. And I haven't looked at prices recently. Have they been fairly stable for rare earths?
Yeah, the prices on the rare earths are a little bit low right now. You're looking at like a neodymium is in the $60 to $80 range. But to your point, with a multi-material kind of offtake agreements, you get to de-risk that from an investor standpoint. I think, too, as you've seen, there was a large announcement recently by the DOD with MP Materials that put a floor out there for the neodymium and the praseodymium. I think that is an important and really a good mechanism to de-risk these investments, particularly on the rare earths where the Chinese have a large influence on the market and can crash the market with a lot of volume and dump the prices. Certainly, even over the last 5 years, you had neodymium selling as high as $140 to $160 per kilogram, And then it dropped down to 50 last year, early this year. So I think that mechanism, and this is an important policy issue that the U.S. government is talking about and seem to be taking steps, given that announcement with MP Materials, is providing a floor for some of these critical materials like NdPr, like scandium, like yttrium, like gallium, all the critical minerals, such that if you and me and other investors say, hey, we want to put money in this, but I want some protection that if the market crashes again, we don't go under. So I think that's a really important mechanism that it seems at this point the DoD is acknowledging is one of the tools in the toolkit to reshore these rare earth critical mineral supply chains.
Right, right. I know as a hydrologist myself, when I was talking to people in Israel, when they were developing all the desalination, they guaranteed the price of desalinated water for 20 years.
Yeah.
If those companies give a chance.
Yeah, you know? Great tool. And I think the DoD Defense Logistics Agency, DLA, can play an important part of that. That's more the executional arm of buying material at a floor price. But yeah, there's a great example. A 20-year offtake with a minimum price, that really helps these businesses. So we're in a pretty tough place because we're so far behind in reshoring and developing the supply chains for critical minerals, not only from a feedstock standpoint that we're talking more about, but then the intermediate processing. I think what's going on right now, as you see in the news, there's obviously negotiations going on between the U.S. and China on what does trade look like. But within Chinese policy, and as I understand it, is that there are restrictions about rare earths going into the defense industry, defense companies. And the Chinese industry are requiring their supply chain partners to report where the critical minerals are going downstream, not just for the buyer of it, but who is all the way down to the consumer. And they have restricted that critical minerals can't go to defense companies like Lockheed, like Raytheon, like the others that play in that market. And then, as I understand it, violators of those policies in the Chinese market are punished severely. And on top of that, they're really asking for supply chain information that I think, as I understand it today, ITAR, which is International Trade and Reporting, actually prohibits supplying that type of information to the Chinese. So it's one of those that you have to peel back the onion a little bit to realize the catalyst for change for reshoring these minerals really is going to come out of the defense industry, because the Chinese are restricting supply chain movement through the chain all the way down to defense companies, even today.
I had no idea about that. And do you think tariffs and things like that will impact?
I think, yes. I think the tariffs provide some additional wind in the sails for reshoring materials.
Right.
It's not necessarily the answer. And I think part of it is because tariffs come and sometimes they go. But I think it does provide some additional wind in the sails, some additional momentum behind some of these investment decisions. But as standing up an operation, even for us, you're looking at 2 to 3 years for standing up operations once you get a go, once you get a financial investment decision. These things don't happen that quickly. So that's part of the challenge is, hey, when you get changes in policy, when there's changes of administration, you're left. So there's risk. There's risk involved. I think the tariffs are helpful, but they're not the answer because they're subject to change.
Right, right. And so are there other points that you would like to make, Chris, that I have missed?
I think we've covered a lot of ground here. We're super excited about what we're doing in the Critical Resource Accelerator. Hey, at some level, this is an issue for our country. Obviously, at the end of the day, we need to return money to our investors. We're a private company. But I think we need to innovate in the area of extraction of critical minerals from alternative sources, from industrial wastes and tailings. That is the best way to reshore these feedstocks, again, which is obviously that's where the process starts. We need the elements coming out of waste. Obviously, we can mine, but those are difficult and it takes a long time and they're costly. But the alternative sources, like we've talked about, fly ash, red mud, there's zinc tailings, there's other industrial waste, low-grade coal tailings. That's the way for us to reshore these critical minerals. And frankly, we can't do it fast enough. I don't know the answer. It's almost like we have to operate on a wartime footing without actually being technically at war.
Right. And I like the point that you made. It's not just the feedstocks, having the feedstocks. It's the processing also. And so it's not just the concentrations, it's the extraction and the cost of all those things. But I think Lynas may be developing a plant in the Gulf Coast region. Do you talk to those people at all? Or
I am familiar with them. They obviously are a large player. Between themselves and Neo Performance Materials are the two largest non-Chinese rare earth processors. And of course, Lynas is also mining materials out of Mount Weld in Australia. So they are taking the lead there. And MP Materials call them on the feedstock and as they move downstream. So those three big players are pivotal. It obviously needs to be much bigger than those three. But I know Lynas has been working on putting a processing plant in the state of Texas, I think south of San Antonio. That'll be a good step. I think it's an illustration of how difficult it is because it's taken longer than most people expected. And I think Lynas would say that themselves, not only from an investment standpoint, finding the right location, finding the people to run these operations, because the expertise in these spaces has really gone away in the United States. So now you're having to retrain a workforce at all levels within that workforce, at the leadership, at the engineering level, at the operator level. And that's some of the gap that we've got to close. And we've got to do it as quickly as we can. So thankfully, Lynas is in the game. MP Materials has got a great resource. They need to push hard. We want them to push hard. So lots. Right. There's a lot going on, but it's complicated.
Right. Well, I mean, the red mud is amazing. It's an incredible resource. And turning waste to resources is fantastic. And zero solid waste, that's amazing. I'm very impressed and really appreciate how rapidly you guys are getting on with the things and hiring people and taking on students from the university and then looking at other feedstocks. We need a portfolio of feedstocks and then a portfolio of processing approaches to make this work. So it's looking very promising. A guest today is Chris Young from Element USA. Thanks a lot, Chris, for talking about Element USA.
Hey, I appreciate you having us on this. Thanks, Bridget.